Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 13-941, State of Ohio, ex rel. Donald Yeeples and Deborah Yeeples versus the Honorable Stephen E. Gall et al. For the appellant, Mr. Maestel.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the court. Sean Maestel on behalf of the appellant's Precision Directional, as well as the co-employee Gary Cole. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. In any mandamus action, the realtor, the appellee in this case, had the obligation to prove a clear legal right and entitlement to the writ requested. In this case, as the appellate court did state correctly, is that legal right to entitlement is derived and dependent entirely on whether or not he can present a claim for a workplace intentional tort from one employee against another employee under this court's decision in Fife versus Geno. Because this court's decision in Fife versus Geno, or any of the decisions leading up to Fife versus Geno, do not in any way support a claim from one employee against a co-employee, we believe there is absolutely no legal entitlement to relief here because there's no recognizable claim pled against Mr. Cole. The history of the workers' comp system and the claims via the employee against the employer have had a long history where we have had situations where immunity was created for the compensation for any injury that occurred within the course and scope of employment. This court, after that immunity was granted and the quid pro quo was reached between the employee and the employer, this court deemed that those derivative claims and the immunity recognized thereof may not sufficiently protect the employee. So this
you're talking about the substance of what an employer intentional tort consists of.
Correct, Your Honor.
But the case on appeal to us doesn't concern that, does it?
Isn't it a
mandamus seeking to have the trial court judge accept venue? Isn't it an order on Judge Gall?
Well, it is, Your Honor.
Well, if it's an order on Judge Gall, don't we look at the requisites for mandamus?
We do, Your Honor. And the first requisite is that the realtor has to show a clear entitlement
it's
to relief.
It's a relator. It's not a realtor.
I
decision about property.
The relator has to prove a clear legal right to entitlement. And in this case, as the appellate court noted, is in order to show that, they have to show a recognizable cause of action against Mr. Cole, which in the venue issue is inextricably intertwined with whether or not there's a recognizable cause of action against Mr. Cole pled in the underlying complaint, which then was brought through to the 8th District on the venue issue.
Well, the case
issue
isn't even with Judge Gall, is it?
No, and that's the second point we raised in propositional law number 3 is the Cuyahoga County, Judge Gall issued his order to transfer the file to Medina.
And it's in Medina.
And the appellate court's, the writ was filed in the appellate court after it was already in Medina County. And Judge—
Has it been assigned in Medina County? Did they accept the case in Medina County?
Judge Collier, after the case reached Medina County, the relators filed a motion to stay at the same time they filed the contemporaneously this writ action. The judge in Medina County said, I'm not accepting or rejecting jurisdiction at this time.
So it's in limbo right now in Medina County.
Well, I don't agree it's in limbo in the sense that he then subsequently said that he was reconsidering his decision to send it back based on the 8th District's decision until this court reached a ruling.
Right, so there is no ruling out of Medina County yet?
Except for, correct.
Okay. Is it, in your view, ever possible for an intentional tort to be prosecuted between employees?
Under a common law traditional intentional tort, assault, battery, trespass, intentional infliction of emotional distress, yes.
Okay, but under the scheme that the Yeeples have pled, does that allow for an employee to employee intentional tort?
Not in our opinion, Your Honor, based on the history of this jurisprudence.
Okay. So your position is that there is no entitlement to the writ because they're not entitled to the relief that they're seeking, and they, even if they were, it wasn't pled in a manner that would have brought, I believe Mr. Cole is the name of the co-employee, to be brought in other than in a nominal status, correct?
That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. That's our position in total. And we believe that that's a correct position that this court should rule because of...
Counsel, would you agree that Ohio is a notice pleading state?
Yes, Your Honor, I would.
And how do you therefore square this complaint with what the Court of Appeals is saying? Well, if you move a few verbs around, you know, everybody's on notice what's being said here. Doesn't that vest the court with jurisdiction?
Well, I think it goes back to, again, the fact that it's in a writ, Your Honor, because they have to prove the clear legal entitlement to the right. You then look at the underlying complaint, and there is no recognizable cause of action against Mr. Yeeples even pled. Against Mr. Cole even pled in the underlying complaint.
But there's no requirement that they prove anything at the pleading stage, is there?
Well, because it's a writ action, we believe there is.
Why?
Because they have to show a clear legal entitlement to the writ. And because they have to prove a clear legal entitlement to the writ on venue, the venue issue is inextricably intertwined with whether or not a recognizable cause of action has been pled against Cole. And as such, we then believe that if it falls by a house of cards, if Mr. Cole does not have a properly pled action against him, there's no clear entitlement to relief, there's no venue because he's only a nominal party, has no claim is present against him, and the case should be in Medina County.
When you call him a nominal party, what do you mean?
Existing in name only. In Smith versus Inland out of the 11th District Court of Appeals, the court talked about the issue, a pretty similar issue as this. It was an intentional tort case where the supervisor was brought in and named, and the court it was filed in Lake County where the supervisor lived. The court sent it to another county on the basis that he was named only for the purpose of obtaining venue.
But that gentleman wasn't even on site when the accident occurred. But here, Mr. Cole was, in fact, he was the operator of the instrumentality that caused the injury.
He was, Your Honor, except for the fact that we still don't have a traditional cause of a common law intentional tort pled against Mr. Cole. There's no allegations in the underlying complaint that Mr. Cole in any way intended to harm Mr. Yeeples.
So that if there had been in the complaint, there had been a common law action asserted against Mr. Cole, then we'd have a different situation. Is that your position?
Oh, I agree. If Yeeples would have pled against Mr. Cole that he assaulted him or committed battery or one of the other traditional common law torts, we believe then, yes. I mean, yes, venue would, he would not be a party in name only. He would actually have a viable or a recognizable cause of action against him. And therefore, the writ would be under a different light.
But the Court of Appeals seems to believe that this was a Blankenship case. I noticed that brought us all back to our youth.
Well, it did, Your Honor, and that's where Mr. Flowers...
They call it a seminal case. I would agree. Would you?
Well, Blankenship was a seminal case, and then the court sets forth the standard, which then gets modified eventually in Fife and now has been changed substantially by the legislature. But if you look at the underlying basis for why this court ever created that direct liability, none of those policy considerations apply here. And there's no reasonable explanation or no reasonable basis to extend the Blankenship line of cases to an employee visa employee situation. We don't have a control over the employee by another employee. The reason Blankenship came into existence, in my opinion, was because of the control the employer could exert over the employee and the safety issues that were at issue there. You don't have those same issues here.
What would we write then in relationship to the standard for employee to employee intentional tort? If you prevail and we say that it doesn't relate, this cause of action is inappropriate, it's not cognizable because of the failure of the pleadings, and what would be necessary in order for this to be a cognizable event or cause of action against Mr. Cole? What would the points have to be that we should put in the opinion?
Well, I think, Your Honor, straightforward, it would have to say that the Fife versus Geno line of cases, which have been abrogated by the legislature, don't apply at all to an employee intentional tort situation. Number two, that the employee would, in order to maintain action against his co-employee, would have to plead a traditional common law assault, battery, trespass, if that applied, or intentional infliction of emotional distress. Those are the four basic common law intentional torts that Ohio has recognized over the years.
But where does he end up, even if he pled that, against this employee for an intentional tort? How does that translate to, you know, what people are looking for here, which would be a deeper pocket?
Well, frankly, I don't believe that you get to a deeper pocket under either scenario, but that's not what we're looking at here. The issue is whether or not Mr. Cole can get compensated for his injury. And if the issue is whether Mr. Cole can get compensated for
Mr. Cole.
Mr. Yeeples.
Yeah, I understand that. And I know the issue before us is venue and whether Mr. Cole's action here is sufficient to allow this case to be filed in Cuyahoga County versus Medina County. But we still, I think, are going to have to address the issue of employee-to-employee intentional tort. And under the guidance that this court would put into that opinion, there's going to be some standards there. And you say that it has to be, the complaint would have to allege one of the common law torts in order to allow for Mr. Cole or another employee, you know, an employee-to-employee tort, correct?
Correct.
Would there have to be an allegation that the injury is not compensable under workers' compensation statutes?
The question then would be whether or not 4123-741 would apply in the fellow servant immunity. And if I recall, that case law is, if it is compensable by the Ohio Workers' Compensation Act, immunity may apply, but if it occurred outside the course and scope of the employment, truly as an assault or battery would, then there still would be, and from what I've read, the immunity would not apply. And Mr. Yeeples, in this case, could proceed against Mr. Cole under that basis.
Would that be a crucial or critical part of the complaint to withstand, a judgment on the pleadings?
I think there would have to be a statement in the complaint that said whether or not workers' comp was applied for and whether or not it was granted, although there's some case law that says also that even if the Bureau of Workers' Comp gives coverage, that doesn't mean that a subsequent action can't take that coverage away.
Counsel, because this is a writ action, we have to also consider whether there's an adequate remedy at law. Why would a motion to dismiss and an appeal from those actions at the trial court, why is that not an adequate remedy here?
Only because this court in Smith versus Cleveland Clinic, I believe, stated that it was not an adequate remedy, that in a venue dispute, they didn't have to wait until the end of the day, until the end of the case, after a motion to dismiss, to determine whether or not they could file a writ.
So we have to, rather than look at this as a failure to state a claim, we have to keep characterizing it as a venue case.
Well, you do, but in the essence of, because it's still, you still have the three prongs of a writ, I'm not saying that this court could not find that there's an adequate remedy at law, because after a motion to dismiss, I believe there would be. But I think based on the way the current state of the law is from that decision, I would be hard-pressed to argue. I think I think you'd have to reverse that decision in some essence, or somehow distinguish it in order to fall under that prong of the writ parameters. I don't think we need to go there, because I think under prong one, there is no clear legal entitlement to the writ.
Well, there's two writs here, aren't there? A mandamus and a pro sedendo?
And they both, my understanding, in my review is they both, the first prong of both is whether or not you have a clear entitlement to relief.
Or whether the court has a clear legal duty to act.
Correct. And in this case, under the pro sedendo, we would say there's no, even if the writ, the one interesting thing here is even with the writs granted, it doesn't compel Judge Collier down in Medina County to send the case back. I mean, that's where there's really a lack of jurisdiction as to part of the issue.
How could we possibly issue a writ of pro sedendo against Judge Gall in Cuyahoga County when the physical file is in Medina County?
I agree, Your Honor. And I'm not saying for you to issue a writ. I'm saying for you to reverse the issuance of the writ on the basis that there was no clear legal entitlement to relief requested by the relator.
There's no duty on Judge Gall's part to do anything, is there?
I don't believe there is.
But if the writ would be granted, would it be then incumbent upon Judge Gall to vacate his order transferring this to Medina County, and that's how it then lands back in Cuyahoga County's lap?
That's an interesting question, Chief Justice, because in my opinion, he does not have, there's no jurisdiction. He has no jurisdiction over that file. I mean, I guess he could
issue— Not unless
issue,
we give him jurisdiction back by ordering him to vacate his order transferring it.
But if that happens, that doesn't mean that this court's not ordering Judge Collier in Medina County to send the file back.
Well, if you proceed logically, then there's no order that transfers it to Judge Collier. He has no authority to have that in his possession, so he needs to, you know, divest himself, which I think he probably would readily do.
I agree, Your Honor. I guess it comes down to the question of the argument we had was that there's only jurisdiction in one court at a time, and that currently it sits in Medina County.
What do you think the rationale is for wanting to go to Medina as opposed to Cuyahoga?
I believe that the juries in Medina County are different than the juries in Cuyahoga County. I think that would be the main reason.
That's basically what we're arguing about.
It seems to be the reason why the complaint was drafted in such a way to even try to get venue in Cuyahoga County. I believe that's the underlying goal here, forum shopping.
Thank you.
Counsel, one last question, if I may. But that's exactly what the Court of Appeals did, correct? They told Judge Gall to vacate his orders and to proceed to adjudicate it on the merits.
He does.
That's what's before us today.
Well, correct, Your Honor, except for the fact that we believe that there was no clear legal entitlement.
I think
the Chief Justice is right. I mean, I think that practically that would exactly what would occur, but...
I'm agreeing with the Chief Justice as well. I'm just trying to figure out. We are here because the Court of Appeals said, hear this case in Cuyahoga County.
And we believe they erred under the first prong of the writ.
That's why we're here this morning.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court. My name is Paul Flowers. I represent the relator appellee, Donald and Deborah Yaples. This is a mandamus action. We're here on a direct appeal from an 8th District decision that was rendered in favor of my clients, and I think it's important to start with the initial requirements for mandamus, and the most important of which is that there must be a clear legal right. And here, the clear legal right has nothing to do with proving an intentional tort claim. The clear legal right is the right to have this personal injury case heard in a court of law. And that right is being denied to my clients because two courts can't agree on which one should hear the case.
Just want it in a court of law.
Correct.
But you want it in the Cuyahoga County Court of Law. You're not satisfied with the Medina County Court of Law.
I grew up in Medina, and I love Medina County, but Cleveland's a lot closer for us.
Closer
to your heart.
Yes. Just trying to save on gas money.
Okay, so geography is our only concern here, is that correct?
Yes, correct.
You're not standing there with a straight face and telling me that.
No.
Okay.
These venue issues are carefully thought out, I can assure you, and they are important. But here, it is a mandamus case. And the only question before this court that there ever has been is whether or not Mr. Cole is in this just as a nominal party. If he isn't, if he's a legitimate party, then this case belongs in Cuyahoga County.
Is there a cause of action pled against him in the complaint? If I understood what Mr. Mestel argued to us, he said, well, there's no intentional act. There's no assault. There's no battery. There's no common law intentional tort been filed against him. And so the pleading on its face is deficient.
Hey, that's,
and I think if I'm hearing his argument, the essence of it is there's nothing there.
And I'm sure the court will look at the complaint, but what their argument is that you don't say Cole specifically enough. You use the word defendants. And they made this argument in the Court of Appeals, and they're pursuing it now, that since we said defendants plural, not Cole singular, we're not alleging it against him. And the Court of Appeals just shot that down. I mean, they use the term defendants in the plural to refer both Cole and Precision over and over, and that's what we were doing in the complaint. Now, an amended complaint was filed just to clear this up.
What was the cause of action alleged in the complaint?
So then that brings to the cause of action. The cause of action is an intentional tort, all right? Assault would fit here. I mean, you back into somebody with a tow motor. That is an assault. But it's bigger than that. He's trying to pigeonhole.
Does that occur within the course and scope of employment? Does the injury occur within the course and scope?
From what we know right now, it did. Right? I mean, right
now
it
sounds like. And is that amenable then to workers' compensation or not?
Oh, yeah, it is. It is for sure. It happened in the course and scope, and that's typically what happens in all these workplace intentional tort cases. But what they're trying to do is pigeonhole this into a set category, assault, battery, trespass, whatever. And an intentional tort is really broader than that. It's any wrongful act that produces an injury that has a mens rea that's greater than recklessness, all right? Anything that you do that harms somebody that is done with substantial certainty of injury, that's an intentional tort.
But you're not alleging Mr. Cole did that, he intentionally backed into Mr. Yaples.
We're alleging he intentionally backed that tow motor, and he did it knowing that it didn't have the backup alarm or the safety features.
Okay, but that wasn't under his control.
I believe it was.
Or not to have the backup and the safety features on a vehicle he didn't own, he was merely operating as an employee. You want to link say that he had control over that vehicle?
We'll have to, you know, flush it out in discovery, but it's entirely possible he knew that, and any employee in that situation has an obligation to say, I'm not driving this in this condition. You know, I could injure my coworkers. And the testimony may come out that he says, I knew that Donald Yaples was behind me, but I figured I could back up because he'd be smart enough to get out of the way. I mean, things like that come out fairly regularly in these cases. That would be an intentional tort. The injury was substantially certain to occur. He knew that, and he proceeded anyway. That's the classic intentional tort claim. So it doesn't have to be pigeonholed into assault, battery, all those. It's intentional just because he acted with the substantial certainty of injury.
But hasn't substantial certainty been modified now to be deliberate intent rather than saying, well, you know, I could possibly avoid him, which to me seems reckless. Wouldn't you have to say, I'm going to mow him down? I mean, we're talking deliberate as opposed to substantial certainty these days, aren't we?
Well, let me start off first. The statute only applies to the employer. I mean, no one's arguing here that Mr. Cole has the protection of the statute because he's not an employer. So that's just there for precision. Precision can argue that the statute applies to them, not Mr. Cole. Mr. Cole, if he's liable, is going to be liable under the common law standard that's still left. And here, a jury might agree with what you're saying, that, well, that's just reckless. You know, to do that's just reckless. Or a jury might say, you know, this guy was backing around these workers who were on their feet. You know, this was going to result in injury sooner or later. It was substantially certain to occur, and that's intentional under Ohio law. So it's a dispute. It depends how the mens rea is determined. And it's not, you know, workplace intentional tort, the word workplace just refers to where it occurred. I mean, you could have a situation where a motorist is driving his car through intersections playing a game of chicken where he closes his eyes as he drives to the intersections. He is substantially certain to cause an accident. When he does, that's an intentional tort that is going to entitle the victim to punitive damages, even though it doesn't fall into assault, battery, defamation, all those categories they've listed. Intentional tort.
Are you saying that the complaint itself makes clear that you are asserting a common law intentional claim against Mr. Cole?
Correct. And that's what the 8th District found. I mean, when you realize, I mean, it's rather obvious, the defendants means both Cole and Precision, then yes, it's alleged against both of them. And Cole here is the perpetrator. I mean, this is not something that's been concocted. If anybody is responsible for this, it's Gary Cole. You usually don't have the employee named in these cases because it's a management decision, it's a collective decision that results in the injury. There's no one person you can blame. But here, like in the Stockham case we cited, you do have somebody who is the perpetrator here, who is rightfully named as a defendant in the case, and that's Gary Cole here.
What does the cause of action intentional tort get you that assault or battery wouldn't? Is there an element that's missing from assault or battery or any of the other common law torts? What's the added element that you're looking for?
There is none, and that's my point. It's the same thing. These are just labels. You know, and okay. We talk about an assault being an offense, putting somebody in apprehension of harm, a battery being an offensive touching. You still have to have an intentional act, which is either deliberate or it's substantially certain to result in the outcome.
Then why is it appropriate for you? Why would you, I guess, succeed on a motion to dismiss if you don't say those words, if you don't say assault, you don't say battery? How can you succeed then if you're saying it is the same thing? those are just labels, and we could have used them, but we didn't. Well,
yeah, we could use a battery, you know, a Salton battery. We could use
but you
that.
Didn't.
And you don't have to. It's like the example I gave of the motorist. I mean, that's a wrongful act that has the mens rea of an intent. That's actionable. You don't have to label it an assault because you wouldn't think that.
Even if we accept that and say you don't have to use the label, do you think that you factually supported a claim against Mr. Cole?
Oh, absolutely. Just at the pleading stage?
Naming him specifically.
Correct. I mean, there is no case law that I've ever seen that says you can't use the word defendants in the plural to allege the activity against both of them simultaneously. And they used defendants to refer to themselves throughout their early pleadings. Later they didn't, but throughout their early pleadings they referred to themselves as defendants. It strikes me so contrived, you know, this argument that this complaint has to specifically name him or else they win. You know, that's never been the law.
Counsel, if you managed to have Mr. Cole in and you're alleging that he's going to, potentially be guilty of a common law tort, where does that get you in relationship to Precision, the deep pocket here?
Right. Precision's still in there on respondent superior. As long as Mr. Cole's in the course and scope of his employment, you know, that's always
been
law.
But you're trying to prove an intentional tort, mm-hmm. a battery, which takes him out of the scope of his employment. Nobody hired him to commit batteries with tow motors or excavators.
True. If I could just find my notes for a second. That respondent superior applies even in intentional acts cases, even when there's malice. That's the Stranahan Brothers versus Coit case, which goes back to 1896, and then more recently Osborne versus Lyles in this court in 1992. Those cases hold squarely that as long as the employee is in the course and scope of employment, then respondent superior applies even though the employee is committing an intentional act. Now, if the test—
Wait a minute. And that intentional act is a battery or some sort of tort.
Correct.
You're still going to have the respondent superior. What happens if he got off the tow motor and beat up your client?
Right. Then he's outside the course and scope, and respondent superior doesn't apply.
Well, that's a battery.
Correct.
Okay, so because he used the equipment of Precision, is that the link? How do you differentiate between the two intentional batteries?
Well, that's the big issue. I mean, if the testimony comes out that he's just in a hurry to do his job, he's going to zip around there with this defective tow motor and not giving a care to who's behind him, but he's doing his job, the employer is responsible. If the testimony comes out that he had something against Mr. Yaples and was going to teach him a lesson, you know, by backing into him with a tow motor, then he's outside the course and scope. It's a personal vendetta. So that.
But if he's scurrying around to do his job, you're not going to get an intentional tort out of that.
If he's doing it in a manner where he knows an injury is substantially certain to occur, it is. Or at least a jury could find. A jury could also agree with Justice Lanzinger that it's reckless, you know. It's one of those things has to be sorted out.
Would you get to the jury under the workers' comp situation then? I mean, when you don't have deliberate intent?
Well, with the employer, that's different because you have the new statute with deliberate intent. The employee is still just a substantial certainty intentional tort. So you would get to a jury on that, we're just at the pleading stage, assuming the evidence supports it. But we're not there yet.
Isn't that what the Court of Appeals said? Didn't the Court of Appeals say this is all stuff that will be sorted out when there's a trial in the proper venue?
Yeah, I think they put a sentence in there saying they're not prejudging the case, and I think Judge Collier did too, down in Medina. You know, we're just saying, does this allege enough to keep Mr. Cole in at this stage so he's not a nominal party?
And the defendant, singular, lives in Cuyahoga County, correct?
Right. And he lives there, and that's enough to get venue there. But I mean, really, it's being made much more complicated than it is. If you look at the old intentional tort cases, both Jones and Fife, they developed this three-part test from Prosser and Keaton on torts and from the restatement. Those are tort treatises. They're not workers' comp treatises. So that this whole intentional tort comes out of that common law theory, not a workplace theory. And so like I mentioned earlier, when we talk about a workplace intentional tort, workplace only refers to the location. It's still an intentional tort. It's still proved under the common law standards.
Are you giving us a preview of what you're going to be asking us to do 1 year from now? Is this really not a Blankenship case that we're trying to expand, that employees hurt each other, that it may not be workers' comp, but it may still become pensable?
Well, it is a Blankenship case. I mean, that's true. And Blankenship, you know, it's important here. Blankenship involved a claim not only against the employer, but also against several employees. And in the syllabus, this court says, you know, it cites the two statutes, 7.74 and 0.741. One is to protect the employer and when there's workers' comp, and the other is to protect the co-employees, co-employee immunity. And this court said neither applies in that situation. And so, like in LaCava and in Stockholm, you do have situations where a co-employee can be held liable for an intentional tort. And it's got to be the right situation, but that's the case here. Mr. Cole is the perpetrator. He's properly joined in the suit.
Before you sit down, can you give me your best argument as to why you fit within the ambit to secure a writ of mandamus and a writ of procedendo when a file is in Medina County and the judge is in Cahoga?
Yeah, that's just, you know, my response to that is just happenstance, and it was the same situation.
Can you go through the elements and tell me how you think that we should determine?
Well, the mandamus was properly issued against Judge Gall, instructing him to proceed, and the same with procedendo. Both of them instruct him to proceed with the case to vacate.
But he doesn't have the case because he already sent it away.
Right, and that's happenstance. I'm sure Judge Collier will send the file right back up to him, and he can proceed. I mean, Judge Collier said in his last order that he's not going to take the case. He's going to wait and see. I think he said he'd wait and see what the 8th District does. And it had already ping-ponged back and forth between Medina and Cuyahoga. We'd filed the mandamus action, so that was entirely appropriate for Judge Collier to do.
So really, you want this court to determine which county the case belongs in. That's what you're asking.
Yeah, essentially.
And your writ says Gall has a statutory or obligation to hear the case, and therefore he should be mandamused to do so. And the writ of procedendo says he should commence that activity.
Right, constitutional obligation. So that's exactly our mandamus and procedendo in a nutshell.
And if he gets it and says that there's no cause of action here, he dismisses Cole, then where are you?
If he dismisses Cole, he's had that opportunity, hasn't?
I didn't ask you that he will. I'm just hypothetically posing. If he gets the case back and says, my goodness, Cole is a nominal party, I'm dismissing him, now what?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be the same if
he can send it back to Medina?
I don't want to sound evasive, but if he says that, then Cole's a nominal party would belong in Medina County. But, you know, he should have said that before. I mean, I guess it would strike me as having two opportunities with it for him to say it now. Wouldn't be fitting, particularly after the 8th District says they have a claim, you know, they should be proceeding in Cuyahoga County.
You don't deny that he could do that if he determines that there isn't a cause of action pled for assault and battery against Cole.
He's the judge, so yeah, it's his prerogative.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Maestel, you've used all your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Make no mistake that the issue here is about avoiding the legislative enactment of 2745. We know that employers cannot act without employees. So if this court were to accept the 8th District's decision that Blankenship claims exist vis-a-vis one employee injuring another employee, 2745 is no longer gonna be really applicable to any workplace injury. In this underlying complaint, it was called a workplace intentional tort. It was based entirely on Blankenship. The 8th District Court of Appeals has said Blankenship can support that claim. If you look at the pleading, there is no assault.
Were there allegations against employees in Blankenship?
My understanding is there was, in the underlying complaint, there was an allegation. But if we recall, Blankenship did not say anything more than that an intentional tort occurs outside the workplace, and therefore immunity is not governed. Or not applied. That is the only thing Blankenship says. We don't, in Jones, we come forward with the fact that you can actually have from Prosser versus Keaton, that's where the standard starts to develop. Is in Jones versus VIP, this court said Here's the criteria to set forth an intentional tort to avoid the workers' compensation immunity, and then, as we know, it goes further down that path.
Counsel, did you hear Justice O'Donnell's question? He asked, was there an allegation in Blankenship of employee tort?
And I thought I answered you, Justice.
Yes, but, correct.
But the answer is yes. However,
I didn't hear you say yes.
Okay, I thought I did. But the issue that the court was focused on was not whether or not that was appropriate, that claim could go forward. The court was only questioning whether or not it came to the court on whether or not the immunity statute would apply, not whether or not the claim was viable.
But if Mr. Flowers says we read the complaint as a notice pleading, and it refers generally to defendants in the plural, Cole is included in his view, and it states at least a cause of action for assault. What's your response to that?
I disagree with that, because assault requires that you desire the specific act, not just that injury will substantially
flow. Well, we know assault is an intentional act, right?
It's an intentional act.
So that's outside the course and scope of employment, in your view.
That would be, and he would have to intend. There would be an allegation that Cole intended to drive the Coyote excavator into Mr. Yeeples with knowledge that injury was substantially certain to flow. That's where the substantial certainty comes in an assault and battery case.
Well, Mr. Flowers would like us to generously read that. And if we did, then wouldn't Ben you be proper in Cuyahoga County?
It would, Your Honor, but it would mean that the employer's intentional tort, all the 2745, in my opinion, 2745 would no longer be of relevancy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, gentlemen, and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you.